This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Mala Damati. Welcome to Tuesday. Coming up on today's show, should the COVID-19 vaccine be made mandatory? This is a discussion we'll be having in the second hour of Pacific Beat during our Talanoa Tuesday session. But in this hour, the president of the Fiji Football Association has confirmed that all players, men and women, will have to be vaccinated against COVID-19 if they want to play. Also, a prominent Nevan pastor and leader in the West Papua independence movement has died over the weekend, and tributes are pouring in from across the Pacific.
Frankly, to put it simply, he's a very outstanding community person at all levels. Surely he will be missed.
And while the political stalemate in Samoa continues, the Law Council of Australia has voiced its concern about respecting the rule of law in the country. The president of the Law Council joins me in 15 minutes' time. Those stories and more coming up on Pacific Beat.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Fiji's COVID-19 outbreak continues to grow, with health authorities announcing 89 new cases overnight. The figure is down from the record 105 infections announced on Sunday. But in his daily briefing, the Permanent Health Secretary, Dr. James Fong, predicted case numbers will rise and the daily record will be broken once again. It all means the coronavirus will in fact be a fact of life in Fiji for some time to come, and government agencies, businesses and community groups are taking steps to live with it. Among them is the Fiji Football Association, which has confirmed that all players, men and women, will have to be vaccinated against COVID-19 if they want to take part in their respective national leagues when competition resumes. As Richard Hewitt reports, the FA has stepped in to provide food and supplies for full-time players and their families who are struggling as the coronavirus outbreak continues to get worse.
Times are hard for many people in Fiji right now, and for those who make their living out of playing soccer, COVID-19 has brought their lives to a standstill. But the president of the Fiji Football Association, Rajesh Patel, says they are a family and doing everything they can right now to help those family members who are in need.
An average of about 20 to 25 players per club. We've got 22, 23 district associations, and they're being helped. And it's not only men's, both men's and women's who are helping now.
So by the sound of it, then, the majority of players who would far rather be playing football in the local competitions are doing it pretty tough at the moment.
Well, yeah, some are totally dependent on football is an income for them, and the district associations have got under them. But we as a parent body, we have to make sure that in difficult times we do our corporate responsibility and social responsibility program together with it. Before, we had previously done for the hurricanes and cyclones, and this is a foundation that I've started. It's Football for Hope, and for future generations and future whoever president comes in, this Football for Hope will be there, and it will be like a charitable organisation for the football players.
And when it comes to the relief effort, Mr. Patel says soccer's regional and world ruling bodies have also had a role to play.
It is from our Fiji FA coffers that we have saved, and also from FIFA and Oceania. Certain restrictions have been lifted off so we can help the football family and the football players, and that's how we are funding it. It's about $160,000 that we will be giving in the second phase of food rations, and so that's what we're looking at.
Right now, no one knows when Fiji's national soccer competitions will resume, but in Papua New Guinea, their new NSL season is on track for a July 17th kickoff. And acting competitions director for the PNGFA, Rosie Suai, says there's a chance now that more clubs will be involved than they were planning for.
The number of teams that have shown interest is more than 10. So teams that have paid the expression of interest fee, I have already put them through to the top management and the NSL steering committee. I told them I need some answer before the 17th because the teams will have to know whether they are participating.
Is there a possibility then that the competition could even be bigger than 10?
If the NSL steering committee as well as the PNGFA top management wants that to happen, then they will allow that.
The level of interest is remarkable when you consider that matches will be centralised in Port Moresby and Lae. That means teams from outside the two main cities have to be prepared to set up a temporary base if they want to play.
We have teams that have shown expression of interest from Sipik, from Wewak, from Deng, also Tabu Bill, but I understand Tabu Bill has come down to Port Moresby. So the Sipik Medeng one have to be based in Leh, which is closer to the provinces. If they are going to be participating, they will have to be based in Leh because the games will only be played in Port Moresby and Leh.
But before a ball is kicked in PNG or in Fiji, players are being told they must get vaccinated or they won't be allowed to compete.
It's not only themselves they have to make the choice, but if they want to play in the competitions, we have to protect other lives as well. As a responsible citizen, we have to make sure that the sports stay free of COVID and we can return back to normal as soon as possible. Right now, we don't know what the sports commission is going to make a decision, how they will bring it about the reopening of the sporting events and everything. So this is something we have to preempt it and make sure when they do open it, we are ready with the players and it's safety for everyone.
In PNG too, that will also apply. So as it is now, once I know which team are participating, they will then be told that these are the requirements that the Office of the Deputy Controller has come back to soccer with. They have to comply with those restrictions, get vaccinated and all that.
So there is no choice in the matter. If a player wants to play, they have to be vaccinated.
At the moment, they have to be vaccinated, just like rugby league did. So all the sports have been advised that the competition can continue. They have to be vaccinated, yes. And I think the officials as well, plus us, the staff of PNG Soccer.
So what's been the reaction from players to being told that COVID-19 vaccination is compulsory for them? So far, Rajesh Patel says no one has lodged a formal objection.
They haven't complained to us anything yet, and most players are happy to go with it because they know it's for the safety of their family and also others too.
So each player, presumably, when they return to their clubs as and when the competitions resume, they will have to have some proof of being vaccinated before they can play again.
That's right. The certificate they give, if you've got your first dose, they give you, so when you'll come and get the second dose. And once the second dose happens, there's another date and stand there that you have taken both the jabs. And this is something that they'll have to show us.
And would they be able to play, depending on the timing of the competition coming back, having had the first vaccination but not the second? Because clearly there is a bit of a time lag between the two.
Yeah, they can play after the first jab.
In PNG, Rosie Suai says once the lineup for the NSL has been finalised, there will be rules put in place to ensure that no unvaccinated player takes to the field.
We'll be arranging that with the respective team managers and we'll also work together with the Office of the Deputy Controller.
And at this stage, there's nothing to suggest that the season won't start on time. The rugby league season is up and running now after, I think, a three-week delay, so that would tend to look good for soccer.
Yes, it looks good for soccer because due to what rugby league was experiencing, all other sports know what we have to go through in terms of COVID-19 protocols, the new normal.
Rosie Suai, the PNG FA Acting Competitions Director, ending that report from Richard Hewitt. What do you make of these expectations for COVID-19 vaccinations to be required? Is it potentially even legal? There are some big questions to answer, and we're going to try and do that in our Talanoa Tuesday session. In the next hour, we're joined by John Apted, a Fiji-based constitutional lawyer, and Dr. Colin Tukuitonga, a Pacific public health expert. If you have any questions or thoughts, I'd love to hear from you. Send me a message on our ABC Radio Australia Facebook page and we can put your questions to them. Pacific Beat. In Fiji, debate continues about whether the country needs to go into a full hard lockdown to beat the virus. Over the weekend, the Prime Minister ruled out the move, saying it would be an even greater disaster than the impact COVID-19 is already having. The Foundation for Rural Integral Enterprises and Development is among the groups providing food and other supplies to people who've lost their livelihoods due to the pandemic. Its director, Sashi Kiran, says if a lockdown is to be implemented, a social support system needs to be put in place. She told Girish Salani the government also needs to improve its communication.
You'll see that we're getting a lot of information in dribs and drabs on social media. And one-off announcement, okay, this is, for example, the Prime Minister came out at midnight and said there will be no lockdown. But there's no real time to engage, to ask questions, to understand if there's no lockdown, then how are we going to manage the situation? And if we are going to lock down, because we've seen it has worked in other countries, then it has to come with social protection. It has to come with package for business revivals, for example. At the moment, or the way it has been done, just a lockdown, and then people are hungry and they cannot manage, you know, it's very difficult.
Of course, you are on the record as having called on the government to have a social support strategy. Are you saying the government perhaps isn't doing enough? But because we know that as of last month, it paid out 160 million Australian dollars in unemployment benefits. That's quite a large sum from at least my reading of it.
A lot of that is topping up the social superannuation system. And there's very small amounts, $50 going out to informal sector, $50 for food, fuel, medicine, transportation is very little for family to survive. So there needs to be much more concerted effort in what sort of social protection is provided. People are struggling for medication, for baby's milk, which is one baby's milk formula is, for example, $10 for a week. So there has to be much more thought through social protection packages that actually can survive families.
And alongside those social protections, of course, then there is, has to be protection from the outbreak itself. Would these families that are struggling also support moves for a lockdown, or would they resist or prefer resisting a lockdown?
If their needs are met, I think everybody will go for the lockdown, because at the moment our hospital systems are stressed out. We have hospitals in lockdown. And people are not able to access anything other than COVID support. There's very little support in some of the other health requirements. So it is in everybody's interest to eliminate the disease or try and manage or mitigate as much as we can. So if the community or the people know how the government wants to do this, what are the plans, what are the social protection, how people can get through this difficult time, people will be supporting the mechanisms.
Sasha Kiran, director of the NGO Friend, speaking to Girish Alani on The World on ABC TV.
Pacific Beat.
Well, coming up next, the president of the Australian Law Council joins me to discuss the statement it released on the political situation in Samoa. But this is Can We Get It Together by Solo Rosa and Noah Slee. That was Can We Get It Together by Solo Rosa and Noah Slee.
Pacific Beat.
Australian lawyers are joining a growing chorus of legal experts to become the latest to voice their concern about the ongoing political crisis in Samoa. The country's two political leaders, longtime Prime Minister Tuilepa Salele Maliilengaoi and his former deputy now rival, Fiame Naomi Mataafa, both still maintain they should be Prime Minister and their respective governments should be in power. It's now 9 weeks since voters went to the polls and 3 since the FAST party swore in its MPs in a marquee outside of Parliament because the building was locked, even though the Supreme Court had ordered Parliament to convene. Since then, there have been even more Supreme Court hearings and appeals, which have generally gone in the favour of FAST Party, which then saw Tuilepa accuse the judges of conspiring. Now, the Law Council of Australia says it has full confidence in Samoa's judiciary, and its president, Dr. Jacoba Brash QC, joins me now. Good morning, and thank you for joining Pacific Beat.
Good morning.
Now, this political deadlock has been going on for some weeks now. Why is the Australian legal profession speaking out now?
Because the rule of law matters. The rule of law is what makes a democracy a democracy. So we join with a range of other legal communities in expressing our support for the legal profession in Samoa and the judiciary.
What is most concerning, though, in your eyes about the importance of upholding the rule of law?
That's what makes a democracy, you know, fair elections, independent elections, outcomes that are respected. If you have a difficulty with the outcome, the proper place to go to is the court. And critically here, court outcomes, including appeal outcomes, must be respected.
Now, if there are attempts to interfere or question the independence of the courts, what should happen if that's the case?
Well, judges everywhere, absolutely everywhere, undertake a vital role. They uphold the rule of law. They're the custodians, as are the lawyers that come before them. And they must be able to do their job without pressure, without interference and personal attack.
Now, Samoa is an independent sovereign nation. Should Australia and other countries in the region weigh in on what's going on in their political situation?
Well, of course, Samoa is an independent country with its own legal system and customs. But in any democracy, the avenue for challenging and testing decisions by the courts and the appeals process is the courts and the appeal process, and that should be respected.
You're listening to Law Council of Australia's President, Dr. Jacoba Brush QC, and we're talking about the Australian Law Council's statement on the situation in Samoa. Your language is quite careful. The Law Council calls on all parties to respect the rule of law and democratic processes aimed at the resolution of these issues. But, you know, this deadlock is now heading into its third month and there is no end in sight as of yet. What if it can't be resolved by these legal means?
Well, as a lawyer, all I can urge all communities to do is respect legal outcomes. So following the recent Court of Appeal decision, we should all be reflecting on the importance of the rule of law, the independence of the judiciary, and to remind and remember that all parties should abide decisions of the court. That's how democracies work.
If the rule of law is not upheld, though, for whatever reason, do you think it might set a precedent for other countries in the region?
Well, we would we stand with the judiciary, I should say, and the legal profession, and their respect for the rule of law, because that's what's critical to a democratic government. So all parties should be accountable to the law and subject to the decisions of the court. And we simply remind citizens everywhere, indeed, that that's what makes democracies democracies.
Does this show, though, how fragile democracy is and can be if parties are not willing to accept judgments, if they criticise judges as being, you know, impartial? Where to from there? How do you recover from that?
Well, it's probably timely. It has been some time, as you've said, both since the election and some of the decisions that have flowed. So it's useful. I think it's important to remember at this time that lawyers are bound by, you know, the oath we swear and admission to the profession to uphold the rule of law, to facilitate the administration of justice. So those fundamental obligations are imposed upon all of us as lawyers, and it's useful to recall and remember that right now.
Should the court be holding parties in contempt for criticising and not adhering to, you know, the court's decisions?
Well, the specifics I'm not going to get involved in, other than to say judges everywhere should be allowed to undertake their vital role without pressure, interference or attack.
Dr. Jacoba Brash QC, thank you so much for joining me this morning and chatting about the statement that was released by the Law Council of Australia.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That was Law Council of Australia's President, Dr. Jacoba Brash QC, speaking to me there.
Can you be more Pacific with Sarah Nangama and Dean Halitau? Catch up on all the latest sporting news and meet the biggest personalities in sport from across the Pacific region.
Tamalolo runs out of the tunnel. As he runs out, I believe it's on his left-hand side, he notices his dog is there on a leash with his missus. And Tamalolo doesn't even acknowledge his partner and kisses the dog.
I'll give him a pass because you don't expect to see an animal like a dog, your dog on the field, right? So I'll say he's run out and just like, that's strange. There's a dog. Hey, that's my dog. Oh, my dog. Yeah. And then he goes and gives
him a paddle. Dog?
Yeah, I've got a dog.
What's your dog's name?
Vinny.
Vinny. And yeah. What kind of dog is he?
He's a Bordoodle.
Is that like a bulldog?
Nah, it's a
poodle?
Border collie cross poodle.
Okay, like I was thinking he's of like a bulldog, no kidding, with curly hair. No.
Can you be more Pacific with Sarah Nangama and Dean Halitau? Thursday night, 6 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Hold the front page!
time now to take a look at what's making news across the region. And to do that this morning, I am joined by Liam Fox. Good morning, Liam.
Good morning, Marla.
Now, we continue talking about Samoa because a date has been set for a significant legal hearing regarding Samoa's ongoing political standoff.
Yes, we were just talking about all the myriad legal issues with Dr. Jacoba Brash QC there. And in news out of the Samoa Observer, it says that an application brought by the Attorney General, remember that's the Attorney General for the incumbent HRPP government, has been brought to court to stop that swearing-in ceremony that we saw the FAST party conduct last month outside Parliament. That hearing will begin next week. That is an application by the HRPP to effectively have the court rule that that ad hoc swearing-in ceremony was unlawful and unconstitutional because, among other reasons, it was not attended by the head of state and other dignitaries as required under the Constitution. We briefly went into the history of what's happened ahead of our interview with Dr. Jacoba Brash there, so we don't have to recap the twisted story that's led us to this point. But this would be a significant hearing if the court finds that that swearing-in ceremony was unlawful and unconstitutional. Well, things don't look great for the FAST party there. It would be a significant win for the HRPP. But of course, those issues yet to be discussed in front of the court and be decided. But the Chief Justice has said that the hearing on that application has been set down for next Monday. So hopefully for Samoa's interest that that can be decided quickly.
No doubt a lot of people will be waiting with bated breath to see how that plays out. And it does just show that the situation in Samoa really doesn't have a clear end in sight just yet. But now, Liam, let's turn to New Zealand, because New Zealand's Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern will make a formal apology to Pacific communities over the infamous Dawn immigration raids in the 1970s and the 1980s. This is incredibly significant.
Yes, that's right. It's been described as the equivalent to what happened here in Australia as the Stolen Generation, a traumatic, infamous experience for Indigenous Australians here. And in New Zealand, Pacific Islanders were targeted by police in what is known as the Dawn Raids, when people who were thought to be overstaying their visas were forcibly taken from their homes or workplaces and deported. And the aggressive raids often took place in the very early in the morning or late at night, hence the term Dawn Raids. And it was only Pacific Islanders who were targeted. British or Americans who were overstaying their visas were not targeted, despite making up 40% of overstayers. Now, alongside Ms. Ardern, when she announced the plan to apologise, was the Minister for Pacific Peoples, Opito William Sio, who became quite emotional as he recalled the terrifying day during his childhood when police officers holding German Shepherd dogs turned up at his family home before dawn and shined flashlights into their faces while his father stood there helpless. According to a report out of the Associated Press, Mr. Sio said, "We felt as a community that we were invited to come to New Zealand. We responded to the call to fill the labour workforce that was needed in the same way we responded to the call for soldiers in 1914. And yet this was the kind of thing that happened to Mr. Sio, his family and others. Ms. Ardern said the raids and what they represented created deep wounds, and while we cannot change our history, we can acknowledge it and we can seek to right a wrong. The formal apology is due to be delivered at a commemoration event later this month in Auckland. And Ms. Ardern said it's just the third time the government has made such an apology.
I'm sure we'll reach out to some Pacifica people in New Zealand about their feelings towards this formal apology. But Liam, thank you so much for bringing us those stories.
Thank you.
Time now for a look at the weather in the region. In PNG's capital, Port Moresby, the weather is looking mostly fine with a top of 32 degrees. However, there is a slight chance of rain in the late afternoon, but the percentage there is quite low. There are set to be thundery showers all throughout the day in Port Vila. Showers will clear, though, towards the evening, and there will be a top there of 29 degrees. Mostly cloudy in Suva this morning, but the sun is set to come out in that late to mid-afternoon with a top of 28 degrees. There. In Honiara, mostly sunny throughout the morning with a top of 32 degrees, but there will be clouds about towards the mid to late afternoon as well. The outlook for Apia, a bit of thundery showers this morning, but it should clear to a mostly cloudy day and a top of 28 degrees. And finally, in Nuku'alofa, tops of 25 and a mostly sunny day ahead.
Pacific Beat.
Well, coming up next, you're going to hear the tributes that have been pouring for Pastor Alan Nafuki, who passed away over the weekend. But first, a little bit more music. This is Legality. It's from the Solomon Islands. It just came out this year. It's called Porosi Ao. Bit of Legality for your Tuesday with Porosi Ao. It's from the Solomon Islands and it was released very recently in 2021. I think that's a really great track.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
You are listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Marla Damati. Tributes have been pouring in from across Vanuatu and the Pacific, all the way to the contested region of West Papua in Indonesia after the death of a prominent church and community elder. Pastor Alan Nafuki died at the weekend. Born in 1950 when Vanuatu was still New Hebrides, he lived a busy life serving as a politician, but was also the chairman of the Vanuatu Christian Council. He campaigned for Vanuatu's independence and he was also an avid supporter of the West Papua Independence Campaign, as Carolyn Tiraman reports.
Pastor Alan Nafuki grew up on the remote Vanuatu island of Eremango, where he attended a local mission primary school. It's been said he chose a life of service to right past wrongs. Several missionaries had been murdered on the island that earned it the nickname Martyr Island. So as a young man, he went to study in the coastal town of Rabaul in Papua New Guinea. He graduated as a pastor in the Presbyterian Church before returning to Vanuatu, where he held many leadership roles in the Christian community. But he also served as a member of parliament and helped fight for Vanuatu's own independence from France and Britain. And Pastor Nafuki continued to fight for others too. He was well known for his social justice advocacy, especially for his support for the campaign for independence for the Indonesian region of West Papua. Neil Netaf, a community leader on Vanuatu's Santo Island, says Pastor Nafuki was very passionate about many issues and will be greatly missed.
A community person, a well-known right among the grassroots people, church, as far as up to the national level. His standing in the community, is you can see him visibly on social justice issues. That's apart from just being a minister of church solely. So he's involved with West Papua, he's involved in sports, He's involved in youth work. There's so many, many society activities that he's involved with. So, frankly, to put it simply, he's a very outstanding community person at all levels. Surely he will be missed. Among the government circles, he's a former MP, Member of Parliament, and he still provides very strong support for one of the parties that now in coalition, the Vanuatu Party, and he's very, very powerful and very active person as well, supporting his party, Vanuatu Party, which is the main coalition in the current government. And yes, from the church standpoint on social issues, he left a big hole. Yes, a big gap there as of yesterday. I'm really kind of like, I really don't know who's going to feel and be able to continue to maintain that leadership that he has at that level. So he's just one of those persons that is unique and very popular among the church and the community at large, including the government as well. And not only that, at the regional level as well. The issue of West Papua is just, if I can compare him with some previous church leaders, he stood out the most visibly, and his involvement is much greater. And our friends from West Papua will surely, and so all of us who are supporters of the West Papuan cause will surely meet him.
Tributes have indeed flowed from supporters of independence for West Papua. Pastor Nafuki had been the president of the Vanuatu Free West Papua Association until his death. Ronnie Kareni is an independence activist and member of the United Liberation Movement of West Papua, or ULMWP, who's based in Australia.
The people of West Papua mourns the loss of Pastor Alan Afuki, as we heard about the news. And we greatly honour his service towards the people of Vanuatu through his Christian practice. And more so, his long-time advocacy on the issue of self-determination and decolonization of the people of Melanesia. And particularly when we see with West Papua case, Pastor Alan Afuki has been on the front line in advocating, despite who is in the government, him make sure that the issue of West Papua is at the forefront in Vanuatu's foreign ministerial advocacy or in multilateral conversations or multilateral fora, especially with the MSG meeting, with the Pacific Island Forum, even as far as to the African Caribbean Pacific grouping. He has been staunch in death, and so for the people of West Papua, we also mourn his death, and also as we stand together, we will continue the work, the legacy, the advocacy that he has been doing. And this is a conversation within the West Papuan leadership and the movement to continue to honor him of his service and of his contribution in advocating for West Papua's right to self-determination.
West Papuan independence activist Ronnie Kareni, who is based in Australia, remembering the late Vanuatu pastor Alan Nafuki, who died at the weekend. Carolyn Tierman reporting there.
Island Music brings you the finest reggae from Jamaica and around the world, with a spotlight on the freshest Pacifica talent.
Join me, Rick Howe, for Island Music, a two-hour journey from the foundation of Jamaican popular music, from ska, rocksteady, roots, dub and dancehall, plus the freshest new releases and a spotlight on emerging talent from around the Pacific.
Every Saturday with Rick Howe from 12 till 2 p.m. PNG time on Radio Australia across the Pacific.
Hi, I'm Hilda Wayne. Join me on ABC Radio Australia for Sisters, Let's Talk. I'll be talking to some incredible guests and discussing what matters to Pacific women.
I would like to hear the stories from the women in the Pacific whose lives have changed and become an inspiration to many. This is a place where stories are collected and celebrated.
So join me for Sisters, Let's Talk, Fridays at 3:30 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Well, if you tune in to Island Music this Saturday, you'll hear the latest reggae and dancehall from around the Pacific, but also some traditional music from the Maroba province in Papua New Guinea. Joining us now, of course, to chat about it all is Island Music host Rick Howe. Good morning.
Good morning, Marla. Have you ever heard an orchestra of conch shells playing together?
I don't think I've heard a conch shell played in general.
Okay, well, you are in for a treat.
Oh, I'm so excited.
Because the first tune I want to play, we just do a little bit of it, and I feel like I should manage expectations somewhat. I don't know if you've ever tried to play one, but they're very difficult.
Do you blow in it? Do you tap it?
You blow in it. And you obviously, there's no sort of keys on it or anything like that. So you just have to pick your shell based on its size, based on its tone, based on its pitch.
Mm.
And then you all have to sort of chip in together and try and get a good
instruments
sound.
Instruments before instruments were made. I mean, they're
right.
God's instruments.
Yes. So bear that in mind when you're listening to this. We'll just hear a little section of it, recorded by Jerry Daniels. So this is up in the Morobe province in PNG, and this is some conch shells playing together in unison.
From picking it yourself, for not being an actual, you know, metal instrument. It's pretty good.
Yes, I know. It's very impressive. Also, there's a good video of that as well, which I will put up on the Radio Australia Facebook page so you can see them in action doing it together. But brand new female singer out of Solomon Islands. Shout out everybody tuned in to 107 FM in Honiara. Her name is Legality. She's very new on the scene, and this is her latest tune called Sunshine and Flowers. Surely been devotion.
Legality's voice is amazing.
Beautiful, isn't it?
So good.
And only a couple of tunes under her belt, so really looking forward to what she comes up with in the future. And you'll be hearing more of Legality across Radio Australia during the week. But also over the weekend, we had a new member of the British Empire, meaning an MBE, that award that you get for it's a type of knighthood.
Yeah.
There's many of them. And Dennis Bovell got one, who's a English-Jamaican... Jamaican descent, but an English reggae producer. And he pioneered what's called Lover's Rock in the UK. Now, this is sort of Lover's style reggae, but the thing that was great about it is he wasn't looking to get superstars from Jamaica and try and, you know, put out the best pop records he could like that. He just used everyday singers in the UK, which weren't the most accomplished singers at the time, but was really nurturing the local talent. And it came out with this distinctive sort of English star, which you'll hear here from Brown Sugar, produced by Dennis Bovell. And after that, we're going to hear some of the punk he also produced as well.
Mm.
So first up, this is Brown Sugar. It's a trio of women from South London, and it's called You and Your Smiling Face. So that's a perfect example of Lover's Rock.
I really love it. I love that he, as a producer, fostered that local talent. It is quite lovely.
Particularly female talent as well. This next tune is, this whole album was game-changing, really. This is the first ever all-female punk group in the world.
Wow.
From the UK specifically as well. They're called The Slits, and they came out with this record called Typical Girls, produced by Dennis Bovell. So the reason why Dennis Bovell produced this punk album as well as the reggae stuff is there was this massive crossover of reggae and punk in the 1970s. Bob Marley actually had a song called Punky Reggae Party, which he wrote over in the UK. All about the mix of Jamaicans, and there was also skinheads originally back in the day, the sort of fashion versions rather than the fascist versions, mm-hmm. who were into punk music as well. So there was this real crossover in the UK that happened. So the Slits loved reggae, like a lot of punk groups did, so that's why they wanted Dennis Bovell to be their producer. And this record here called Typical Girls, Kurt Cobain from Nirvana has put this in his top 50 most important records of all time.
That is big.
It's big. There's nothing quite like this. Ari Up is the lead singer, the front woman from the Slits. There's no one quite like her. She's a unique artist, and you'll hear it here from her 1979 debut album, Typical Girls.
Before we get there, though, you haven't plugged your show. We've been chatting for some time now. What if people want to listen to Island Music?
What time would they have to tune in?
A time from 12 to 2 on Saturdays.
That's
on
right.
ABC Radio Australia.
That's right, PNG time. Very good, Marla. You'll be tuning in, no doubt.
Of
and you
course.
Can also listen back, by the way, if you ever miss the program, jump on the Radio Australia website, to the Island Music website, and you can listen back to the show for up to 30 days now. So here's the Slits with Typical Girls, and if we have time, we might squeeze one more in before the top of the clock.
Was a pretty funky track there. Well, punky, I should say. That was the Slits with Typical Girls. That was a UK band in 1979. Well, that brings us to the end of the first hour of Pacific Beat. You've been with me, Marla Damati. Still to come, though, for the second hour, an Australian-owned company has secured a multi-million dollar contract to rebuild a naval facility located on Manus Island, but it looks like COVID-19 has stalled its progress. The G7 summit has wrapped up and a major pledge has been made by the world's richest countries on climate change. What has the regional response been? And, of course, our Talanoa Tuesday on the COVID-19 vaccine and whether it should be made mandatory. I'd love to know your thoughts. Send me a message on our ABC Radio Australia Facebook page and we can share them on air. News is next, but then join me for the second hour of Pacific Beat. Good morning. You're tuning in to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Marla Damati. Coming up this hour, the G7 summit wrapped up yesterday and a major pledge has been made by the world's richest countries on climate change. One regional expert is hopeful that it might mean meaningful change. Also, the US and its allies are set to pull out from Afghanistan in a few months' time, and there are growing concerns about locals who assisted and the ability to resettle them. Now, there are suggestions that some could call the US territory of Guam home, at least for a little while. And our Talanoa Tuesday, we tackle the question, should the COVID-19 vaccine be mandatory? Do businesses and organisations have the right to terminate you if you don't roll up your sleeves? Well, we'll aim to answer some of those questions coming up a little later on, but I would love to know your thoughts. Send me a message on our ABC Radio Australia Facebook page. But next, COVID-19 has stalled progress on the redevelopment of PNG's main naval base.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
The redevelopment of Papua New Guinea's main naval base is facing major delays, reportedly due to COVID-19. An Australian-owned company has secured a multi-million dollar contract to rebuild the facility located on Manus Island. The head of PNG's Defence Force says the project will significantly increase the country's military capacity. While locals have welcomed the investment, they're calling for Australia and PNG to ensure that benefits flow to the community. Marion Farr reports.
In a country surrounded by water, Papua New Guinea's naval infrastructure is key to its national security strategy. On Manus Island, off the northern coast of PNG's mainland, a major naval base is due for an upgrade. It was first built during World War II. The Australian government has committed up to $175 million in funding for the project.
Redevelopment and rehabilitation of Lomburum Base will really set the foundation for our effective maritime patrols.
Major General Gilbert Taropo is the head of PNG's Defence Force.
The redevelopment involves extension of the current war facility, improvement on the electricity, road networks, improvement on our office and accommodation blocks.
The upgrade, which was first announced in 2018, will also include new work, accommodation and training facilities for PNG military personnel, allowing the PNGDF to double the number of troops on Manus Island to 400. Major General Taropo says it will mean a significant boost in maritime security, allowing the Navy to counter illegal activity in PNG waters, such as illegal fishing and drug smuggling. He also says China's growing presence in the region is a challenge for PNG.
In the sense that when we don't have an effective and strong security force element, then we are vulnerable for that country's presence in our country.
Australian-owned company Clough has been awarded the contract for Phase 2 of the Lomburum Naval Base redevelopment. Australia's Defence Department says the project also carries the promise of jobs for around 200 Manus locals. Work was set to start this month, but Major General Taropo says COVID-19 is causing delays because skilled technicians are unable to travel to PNG and construction material supply chains have been disrupted. On Sunday, Manus had recorded a total of 439 cases of the virus.
Yes, we would have started by this year already, but due to COVID, the start time has lapsed.
That's a concern for Manus local Bab Korup, who manages one of the province's largest community notice boards on Facebook. He says the region is in desperate need of jobs and investment since the Australian government effectively closed its refugee processing centres on Manus in 2019. Mr. Korup says Manus has experienced a major economic downturn as a result.
We had over almost 3,000 locals who were employed during the RPC program. And once they were driven out basically by our local government here on the island, the people lost out on those 3,000 jobs.
Mr. Korup says that has led to social issues in the community.
We've had an increase in lawlessness on the island because of frustration that our young people can't find jobs. We've had an increase in domestic problems because families can hardly keep the family unit together because of lack of cash problems. We have so many school dropouts on the island and we don't know where to place them since there are no jobs on the island.
He says many locals are hoping to find employment through the naval base redevelopment.
So that people with skills on Manus Island can be employed and that can have a direct impact to our local economy. It will raise it significantly if that is the case. Now, if Clough doesn't give priority to local content, then that is where there will be issues arising out of what is happening now at Lomburum. Mm.
You sort of mentioned issues there. If there isn't enough local employment, do you think that that would create a lot of tension in the community if there wasn't enough jobs provided and opportunities provided for locals?
There will certainly be tensions. It's not a big island. Everyone knows everyone. And if we don't get a fair end of the bargain, there's going to be tensions.
It's a view shared by Veronica Puto, who was previously subcontracted to supply food for the refugee processing centres. Now, she runs a stall at the local markets in Lorengau, the region's capital.
Right now, there's no cash flow in Manus.
Ms Puto hopes the Lombrum redevelopment will boost the local economy. But she says jobs must be distributed fairly and not given solely to landowners from the Lombrum area.
I have heard that it's only priority to the landowners. The landowners, they'll be the contractors to all, every project that will be done in Lombrum.
In a media statement last month, the Australian Defence Force said the project would create 350 jobs in PNG in total and is expected to inject 146 million kina, or 53 million Australian dollars, into the national economy. But it's not responded to the ABC's specific questions about employment.
Marion Farr reporting there.
Pacific Beat.
Well, members of the world's richest countries are ramping up their action on climate change, pledging to phase out coal-fired power stations, which are responsible for almost 50% of the world's carbon dioxide emissions. The group of seven nations labelled climate change an existential threat and also pledged $130 billion a year to help poorer countries, many of them in the Pacific, adapt to rising temperatures. Australia's Prime Minister Scott Morrison was there too, although only as an observer. He also delivered a pledge to phase out government investment in coal-fired power generation. Australia's Agriculture Minister David Littleproud says the government deserves more credit on its climate progress.
Australia's a fair income country about this. We've got a proud record, and this self-loathing from the left and everyone that has a crack at us should stop belting their own citizens up. We've done a lot of the heavy lifting. We've lived up to international commitments, and we are a good global citizen. Anyone that says otherwise should take a running jump.
But Australia's opposition leader Anthony Albanese says the G7 summit has left Australia increasingly isolated on climate change. Last year, the government provided $4 million in funding for a new coal-fired power station in North Queensland. Mr. Albanese says the government's position on coal is becoming increasingly difficult.
Scott Morrison has to explain how that fits with giving to the proponents of a new coal-fired power plant in North Queensland taxpayers' money in order to have the feasibility study for a plant that he knows is not going to go ahead.
So how is this all being seen in the Pacific? Espen Rodenberg is the climate change advisor for SPREP, the region's peak environmental body. I spoke to him a little earlier about the pledge and what it means for the Pacific.
Well, the 1.5 degrees target has been a long-standing ambition for the Pacific small island developing states to get universal international recognition of that target. It's really the very top that we can't go beyond 1.5. We have numerous scientific studies that show us what the challenges would be. So it's great that that there is now this commitment from the G7 to that target. We've heard that from the U.S. president and also from other leaders. So that is positive. However, it's the details in this plan that needs to be looked at carefully. Because we do know that we're not quite on the right trajectory to get to the 1.5 degree target.
Well, like you said, it's the devil in the details. US President did talk up how they'll end coal-fired power, but like you said, there isn't much details on dates, how he'd potentially get this legislation through. Is there a risk in your mind that some of these big statements won't necessarily be seen through? They will talk the talk, but not necessarily walk the walk.
Well, of course, there is that that danger, that challenge for us. So we need to keep engaged with all major emitters to keep their keep them to their promises. But it is there's only so much that the Pacific small island countries can do. But they certainly have been advocating very strongly for this. Leaders recently were apprised of a report from the International Energy Agency, which states that there really must be an immediate halt to subsidies towards fossil fuel supply. There needs to be no new unabated coal plants or new oil and gas fields or any new coal mines. And there must be a big ramp up of solar and wind capacity, but also a complete coal phase out if we are to stick to the 1.5 degree target.
Now, speaking of that, the G7 members did commit to ending new direct government support for coal power generation by the end of 2021. And it was even revealed that Australia itself committed to that too, even though it's not one of the seven countries. How significant is this for the region, for Australia to make this commitment?
Well, that's certainly welcomed. I think the Pacific leaders will certainly welcome that ambition. I think we need to understand the details of this, how it's going to be implemented. But certainly as an announcement, it would be welcomed by Pacific leaders.
Now, there are also going to offer $2 billion a year to help emerging economies turn away from coal and instead invest in those renewable energy sources that you mentioned. There have been plans for a coal-fired power plant in Papua New Guinea. Could this new funding potentially stop that and redirect it to more renewable sources?
Potentially, yes. I guess it could. I don't have the details of those plans at my fingertips, but certainly getting support for renewables in a country like Papua New Guinea, where there's not universal energy access at the moment, would certainly be a major positive step.
Funding on funding support, the G7 leaders also agreed to make sure that they were meeting a $100 billion pledge on climate finance that helps poorer countries cut their carbon emissions and adapt to the changing climate. Are you hopeful that this particular funding will see work being done in the Pacific as well to help Pacific economies, you know, transition to those more renewable sources of energy?
Well, certainly that would be a positive outcome for us. But we've just gone through a review of climate change finance up to 2020, and we are not convinced that the target that was initially set, the 100 billion target, has actually been met. The reporting is quite obfuscated, to be honest, and it's not very clear exactly where the funds have gone to and how, whether it's actually contributed directly to projects and programs in developing countries like the Pacific. It is a challenge to try and sort of dig through all these financial reports and to try and make sense of it all. We can certainly say that there's been an increase in support to the Pacific in recent years, but certainly not to the level that it really needs to be at.
Now, you know, with the G7 summit coming to a close and these pledges being made, what would you or SPREP like to see being done now? Where to from here?
Well, I think we need to move away from the sort of project-by-project implementation of climate change work. We need to move to a more programmatic approach where there is assurance that projects will continue beyond the usual sort of 4 to 5 year time frame. We need to look at this with a much longer time horizon, and that requires a programmatic approach with the assured funding. This also then needs to be complemented with a much more serious capacity building program in the region to build up the knowledge and expertise in order to deal with the impact of climate change in the region, but also to build up that technical expertise required for solar and wind renewable energy and other forms of renewable energy in the region, because traditionally the energy sector has really been focused on diesel and, where it's been available, hydropower. But we also now need technical expertise in a lot more, a lot of other different capacities.
That was Espen Ronenberg, SPREP Climate Change Advisor.
Pacific Beat.
Well, still to come on the program, the producers of a Hollywood film about the Christchurch mosque terrorist attacks say they're devastated by the pain caused to New Zealand's Muslim community. And the US and its allies are set to pull out from Afghanistan in a few months' time. And there are growing concerns about locals who assisted and the ability to resettle them. Now there are suggestions that some could call the US territory of Guam home, at least for a little while. But it is Tuesday, so it's time for a little bit more music. This is Nairi with Shiver.
Oh, I never thought you'd come to see me, 'cause I'm blinded by the noise and the mess of the city trying to kill me. And I never thought you'd get to feel me when the distance between us is decided by the ocean trying to woo me. Something about my learning, the arithmetic I've been burning, never bothered me one bit until you hit me.
That was Shiver by Nairi. I know I'm shivering now because it is quite cold here in Melbourne, but I'm about to give you a weather outlook, which is a little bit warmer. Well, it's time now to look at the weather in the region. In PNG's capital, Port Moresby, the weather is looking mostly fine with a top of 32 degrees. However, there is a slight chance of rain in the late afternoon, but the percentage is quite low. There are set to be thundery showers all through the day in Port Vila, but the showers will clear towards the evening and the top there will be 29 degrees. Mostly cloudy in Suva this morning, but the sun is set to come out in that mid to late afternoon with a top of 28 degrees today. In Honiara, mostly sunny throughout the morning with a top of 32 degrees, but there will be clouds about towards the mid to late afternoon. The outlook for Apia is a bit thundery this morning with a bit of showers about, but it should clear to a mostly cloudy day and a top of 28 as well. Finally, in Nuku'alofa, tops of 25, a bit cooler there, but a mostly sunny day ahead.
Your home of NRL in the Pacific, ABC Radio Australia.
Comes to the left, Benji. Got the pass away to Keon Kalamatangi.
Tune in on Thursday at 7:05 p.m. as the Brisbane Broncos take on the South Sydney Rabbitohs.
Milford to Asako. Pass one. Weaves in field. Second try, Brisbane.
The Broncos versus the Rabbitohs. Thursday, 7:05 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
That's right, you are tuned to ABC Radio Australia. This is Pacific Beat and I'm Marla Damati. The producers of a Hollywood film about the Christchurch mosque terrorist attack say they're devastated by the pain caused to New Zealand's Muslim community. More than 60,000 people have signed a petition to shut down the film, saying the families of the victims weren't consulted or even warned about the production. The producers say they deeply regret they didn't reach out to all the families of the victims, survivors and witnesses, and they're promising to consult more, as Bridget Fitzgerald reports.
In the days and weeks after the Christchurch mosque shootings, New Zealanders came together in mourning. Footage of these students performing a haka to honour those who died was beamed around the world. With 51 lives lost and dozens more injured, the events of March 2019 are still very raw, and news of a Hollywood film set to dramatise the Australian gunman's attack has been met with anger.
Well, I think it's just plain disgusting.
Umar Kudus is a Muslim man and an Auckland lawyer. He travelled to Christchurch, where he volunteered his time and worked with many of the victims' families. He says they haven't been consulted or even warned about this film.
We were all surprised by it. It was essentially an ambush that a movie was coming out about the Christchurch attacks. And it's disgusting, to say the least, because it's unfortunately the only thing that runs through my head when I think about it is just someone trying to make a quick buck out of 51 dead lives.
US-based company Film Nation Entertainment is in the early stages of producing the film called They Are Us, a phrase coined by the New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern in the wake of the attacks. The film centres around the PM herself, to be played by Australian actress Rose Byrne, and the government's response to the shooting. Anjum Ruchman from the Islamic Women's Council of New Zealand says the backlash against the film rests on the feeling that Muslim victims are being ignored.
You know, it says that Muslim community, Muslim suffering, the response of our community to the tragedy are not inspiring. They're not a story worth telling. It feels really insulting to have all of that sidelined to tell a story about one particular person. And while our Prime Minister did do really well in her response to the tragedy, she was just, you know, one part of the full response.
Jacinda Ardern told TVNZ her government has had no involvement in the film and wasn't consulted.
It feels very soon and very raw, you know, for New Zealand. And while there are so many stories that, you know, should be told at some point, I don't consider mine to be one of them. They are the community stories, are the family stories.
Journalist and poet Mohammed Hassan says any film about the attack needs to focus on what led to the violence.
The role of intelligence and scrutiny of the Muslim community in the years leading up to the attack, while, you know, the rise of white supremacy and white supremacist activity was completely ignored. All of these things are so important when you're trying to tell a story. And let's remember that this is not a story about an industrial accident. It's not a story about a natural disaster. This is a story about an act of terrorism and an act of white supremacy. And if you are not going to tell that story and give it the context that it deserves, then your film really does a huge injustice to the victims of this attack.
One of the film's producers, Auckland-based Philippa Campbell, has withdrawn from the project. And in a statement, she says she deeply regrets the shock and hurt caused by its announcement.
Bridget Fitzgerald with that report.
Pacific Beat.
When the United States and its allies, including Australia, finally pull out of Afghanistan in 3 months' time, there are grave fears for thousands of locals who worked with them. Advocates say the lives of local Afghan support staff, who often worked as translators, will be at risk, likely targeted by the Taliban. The US and the UK are promising to rapidly resettle thousands of them, and there are suggestions that some could call the US territory of Guam home, at least for a little while. Guam's Governor Lu Leon Guerrero has written to the US President Joe Biden, pledging her support to help as permanent plans are put into place. Catherine Grau's taken a look at the story. So what more do we know, and why is Guam making this offer?
Well, the United States and its allies, including Australia, have been in Afghanistan for the past two decades. They went in after, of course, those attacks on September 11th in 2001 in what the US government called its war on terror. In that time, 39,000 Australians were deployed there, but it was, of course, a much bigger cost for the US at its peak. It had 100,000 soldiers there at one time in 2011, and in total it lost just under 2,500 soldiers who were killed while serving. Now, the US President Joe Biden's announced back in April that they would all now be leaving by September 11th this year, of course, marking the anniversary of those attacks. And Australia, Germany and the NATO forces still there are all following as well and will be leaving as by that time too. Now, of course, they worked with thousands of local Afghan people. Most of them were translators or people who might have worked to these countries' embassies and provide other support. So now there's fear that these people, once the US and Australia, etc., leave, that these Afghan people might be targeted by Taliban forces. In fact, the ABC reported only last week that translators who had been employed by Australian troops have been placed on a Taliban so-called kill list. Now, the Taliban has since assured people in Afghanistan of their safety. Most don't believe that, though, and thousands of people have applied to have their visas to leave the country. There are reports that more than 17,000 who serve with the US forces actually have pending visa applications. And, of course, there's not very long to go with the deadline of September 11th. So, as we've heard, the governor of the US territory of Guam has suggested that perhaps they could be part of a solution. They're offering to be part of talks to see if Guam might temporarily resettle at least those wanting to get to the United States. And Guam's Vice Speaker Tina Munya Barnes has thrown her support behind the idea, and I spoke with her earlier.
For me, it's really important, and for me, it literally goes back to what my parents have taught me. And in the Chamorro spirit, the word is Inapa Malik. I believe in my heart that the people of Guam are resilient, having overcome world wars, centuries of colonization by three foreign oppressors, natural disasters, tragedies, as well as global pandemics. I want to share with you that the people of Guam have been able to come together and rebuild. In this effort, I want to share that the Afghan refugees that we are talking about risk their lives to help out our Americans and also the Australian sons of and daughters of Afghanistan. And I also want to say that as a wife and a mother of veterans, as the grandmother-in-law of an active duty deployed soldier, as a proud daughter of Guam, anyone who supports our sons and daughters is a friend of mine and a friend of Guam. I will be meeting with some of the advocates who are pushing for this also nationally. And I echo our governor's sentiments that should Guam be called to serve, at least allow us to have a say. And we also want to make sure our allies have an easy transition. And I think it's important that our government stakeholders are brought to the table so that we can execute this mission successfully.
This concept, I understand, is really just a temporary idea. It's not to permanently resettle refugees. Is that right? And if so, what kind of capacity do you think Guam could have to bring in refugees? Because I understand there are at least 17,000 who served with American forces who have their visa applications pending. So, I mean, technically, we're talking as many as 17,000 people.
It would be a transition. It's like a thorough point going through, passing through, like we have done in the past with the Vietnamese refugees and all the other refugees who have come through here in the past. We have a place where we call our hotel row, where facilities in Tumon area have the capabilities of holding thousands and thousands of tourists. We also have facilities in the naval base and also with our northern military installation, Anderson Air Force Base. So if you're looking at facilities and space-wise, we have had that opportunity to utilize these facilities.
Now we're in a more unprecedented, different situation. It is, of course, the COVID-19 pandemic. Would now be the right time? Wouldn't it be risky for the local population?
That's why we want to see that the table. I want to share with you that our governor, our Magahaga, our governor of Guam, has a team of surgeon cells who have been on the front lines combating COVID-19. We have a lot of protocols in place. Guam has fared very well. Our community has adhered to a lot of the guidelines to help protect themselves. It's been a community effort, and Guam is really resilient, and we've always stepped up to the plate in times of need.
People may not be aware, but Guam took in literally tens of thousands of people who were Vietnamese refugees. That was obviously quite a significant effort. Is it, I guess, you're hoping to draw on those lessons and experiences?
Yes, we have. And I want to share with you, even with that playbook, I'd like to say that if I can share a reflection on a story of a man that I'm very proud to call my friend, Dr. Hoa Nguyen. When fleeing the fall of Saigon, Dr. Hoa came to Guam as a young boy and was part of the more than 130,000 people evacuated from Vietnam by air and sea during Operation New Life. And I want to say that was the late 60s, early 70s. Dr. Nguyen gratefully recalls being a small boy treated with kindness by the Guamanians here on our island. He met during his first days in America, and I want to share with you today that he has come back and opened 3 medical clinics on Guam. He has served as a former state surgeon, and now he is on the front lines again for our fight against COVID in his capacity as the chairman of the Governor's Physicians Advisory Group. And Catherine, I want to share with you that the spirit of Inna Famalic that was extended to Dr. Nguyen is the reason that 56,000 Guamanians have access to health care. Just thought I'd share that with you, because when we need to come together as an island nation helping out others, Guam has been a big player in incidences and in events that have happened in the past 5 decades. And we truly have been resilient, and we've overcome a lot of the challenges, and we've prevailed.
Guam's Vice Speaker Tina Muyaban speaking there with Catherine Grau.
You're listening to Pacific Beat.
It's time for our regular Tuesday Talanoa, and today we're going to focus on COVID-19 vaccines. Should the coronavirus vaccine be made compulsory, or should they be voluntary? There have been reports out of the Pacific recently that workers are being forced to get the COVID jabs if they want to keep their jobs. It's triggered a debate around people's individual rights and workplace health and safety. Now, there are no studies on this issue that look specifically at Pacific nations. There's research done in Australia which has found that over 3/4 of the Australian population support mandatory vaccinations. So can the Pacific governments find a balance between keeping their citizens safe from the deadly coronavirus without impacting on their rights? That's the topic for today's Talanoa session. And to discuss it, we're joined by John Apted, a Fiji-based constitutional lawyer, and Dr. Colin Tukuitonga, a public health expert that focuses on the Pacific and the Associate Dean Pacific at the University of Auckland. Good morning to you both and welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Let's start with you, John. From a legal point of view, can people be forced to take vaccines?
I speak only for Fiji here. I'm not an expert on any of the other Pacific Island constitutions or human rights laws. But as a basic rule, people cannot be forced by the government to take a vaccine into their body. It under our constitution, there's a right, an absolute right that protects you from compulsory scientific or medical treatment, and your body is sacrosanct. So you can't, by law, or the government can't make it compulsory for you to take it. However, whether an employer can make it mandatory is a different issue.
So say an employer does make it mandatory, says you must get the jab or you cannot work, John. Do those who don't want to take the vaccine have any legal bearing there? Do they have any legal avenues in which they can pursue?
Well, although the public and employers like black and white yes or no answers, there is no yes or no answer to that question. As with all rights and all employment situations, it's an exercise in balancing. It's very, very circumstantial. How you balance your right to determine what happens to your body needs to be balanced against, you know, other people's rights to health, to life, to safe work practices. And how you do that balance depends on your workplace, what your role is, what alternatives the employer can introduce to maintain safety for everybody, and also the COVID situation in your country. For example, what's reasonable in New Zealand at the moment or Australia might not be reasonable for Fiji or Papua New Guinea, where we are battling growing rates of infection.
So, John, would it require the government then to pass legislation to protect employers who potentially want to make the vaccine mandatory for its employees?
In my personal view, the government should lead. Otherwise, without any lead from the government in terms of laws or clear policies, you're leaving it to employers to make up their own minds in different workplaces, and you'll have great inconsistency, great confusion, and you're also leaving the employers exposed to legal action from their staff, and it'll be chaotic. It's so much easier if the government led with a law, so that if there is a challenge, it's to the government's law, and in the meantime, employers apply that law. It would help if there were very simple workplace guidelines put out by the government, either through the OHS, Department of the Ministry, or appropriately the Human Rights Commission in Fiji, that helped employers go through a list of considerations to reach the right decision for their workplace and for the particular roles that are involved.
So,
and when I say roles, I mean, like, if certain roles can work from home quite safely, there's no justification for making it mandatory for them. But if you are front-facing, you work in a factory, there's a greater justification for directions.
Now, stepping aside from the legal part of this conversation, Dr. Tukuitonga, what is your reaction from a public health perspective? Should the vaccines be made mandatory in the Pacific?
No, I don't believe the vaccine or any health intervention should be made mandatory for anyone anywhere. It's an absolute, I think, abuse of individual rights and possibly not justified. Having said this, I think John is right. There is no country in anywhere in the Pacific that I'm aware of where there is legislation that requires this. Having said this, I want to just highlight two points. One is, it's common practice by policy here in a variety of workplaces in New Zealand that people are required to have the vaccine. In other words, it's mandatory. And if people opt out of getting the vaccine, then they cannot continue in their place of employment. Now, I know there's going to be a whole set of legal ramifications for that, but as I say, here in New Zealand, the government's made it quite clear: if you work at the border, you must be vaccinated, and if you choose not to be vaccinated, then you cannot continue in that employment, and you negotiate with your employer alternative arrangements, or you simply can't work there. The other thing to say, of course, is the absence of legislation does not mean it cannot happen. You'll recall in Samoa, in 2019, the government simply made a direction, policy decision, I suppose, that everyone in Samoa were to be vaccinated against the measles. And the government, I'm not sure exactly what they did, but they did compel everyone in Samoa within the requirements to be vaccinated for measles. So, no legislation anywhere, as far as I am aware, requiring compulsory vaccination, but it doesn't stop policy and very specific policies that require certain workers in particular to be vaccinated.
Speaking there of Samoa and the measles outbreak, you know, a thing that did drive a lot of people to get the measles vaccine was seeing all the deaths and seeing the destruction that measles was wreaking havoc in, you know, Samoa and other parts of the Pacific as well. Do you think, you know, as a public health expert, there needs to be stronger messaging and stronger media presence in terms of the impact that COVID-19 is having? Do you think that would potentially compel more people to you know, roll up their sleeves and get the injection?
Yes, I do. I think there's clearly a need for more information for people around the region in all different ways. You know, the difference with measles and Samar, of course, as you point out, there were 80-odd deaths, particularly in children, and it had a huge impact on the community. We don't actually see that. We haven't seen that here, with the exception of Fiji and Papua New Guinea, as John says. Unfortunately, there's been no deaths as such as what happened with the measles in Samar. But we do need to make sure that we provide as much information as we can in order for those catastrophic scenarios not to occur in small islands.
You're listening to ABC Radio Australia. This is Pacific Beat. I'm talking to Fijian lawyer John Apted and Dr. Colin Tukuitonga from the University of Auckland on whether the COVID-19 vaccines should be made voluntary or potentially mandatory. John, I do want to ask, does your own law firm have a vaccination policy? Do they say that you must be vaccinated in order to continue to work?
No, we don't, because we can work from home. Our office happens to be highly automated. So the majority of staff can work from home and are working from home. We also have very spacious offices. So we do have a couple of people come into the office to deal with accounts and that sort of thing, but they can work safely at a, you know, separate with appropriate separation. So we at the moment are not we're not under any pressure to introduce that. But it would be different if we ran a factory or something like that.
But what about those particularly, you know, lawyers who have to go to court and have to go into the community in that way? Should they potentially get, you know, should they be asked to show that they have been vaccinated to protect, you know, other people in the, you know, the court facility, but also bringing it potentially into the office or to their families at home?
That's a very, very important question for us. We haven't, as a partnership, decided on the answer. It's been postponed by the fact that the courts have been closed, and an announcement came out a couple of days ago that they're closed again until the 15th of July. So for the time being, we don't need to make that decision. But as and when they do open, we may ask our staff, and we hope they do the right thing, to get vaccinated if they haven't already.
And what is the current feeling in Fiji among your colleagues, but also, you know, in Fiji in general, as the cases do increase? How are you and those around you feeling about, you know, the situation and potentially urging to get vaccinated?
I'm on social media a lot, and my reading of social media over the past couple of days has been that there's been a sea change. Up until a few days ago, there was huge resistance and suspicion on social media. Related to it was this belief that we could defeat COVID through lockdowns, through more stringent lockdowns. But I think more people are realizing that as the numbers grow and the government has made clear that there will be no more strict lockdowns, it's very unlikely, and that in fact they're aiming to lift restrictions, people have realized that vaccination and vaccinating our way out of it is the only option. And judging from what I see on people's walls and on their pictures, greater numbers are turning up for vaccination now.
You know, with the growing outbreaks in some places of the Pacific, that, like you said, John, is spurring some people to get vaccinated. But Dr. Colin Tukuitonga, how do you convince the adult population of a country that potentially doesn't have COVID outbreaks, that isn't seeing rising case numbers and isn't seeing, you know, deaths? How do you convince them that the COVID vaccine is effective and needs to be taken?
Well, I have to say that for many of the islands, they have a good history of accepting immunisation. Small islands in the region for routine immunisations, with the exception of the experience in Samoa, by and large, they've had always had high coverage rates. In other words, there's a general acceptance by most in the community that immunisation is a good thing. And so we've had very good coverage for most of the vaccines around the region for many years. And UNICEF, WHO, SBC and the countries have done a good job in informing and supporting families and individuals to get vaccination. And so I'm hoping, and of course many in the region expect, that these traditionally high levels of acceptance will flow through into COVID-19. The added impetus with COVID-19, of course, is the concern that people have that this is a new experience. And as John says, particularly if you have a higher likelihood of outbreak, people will be encouraged to get vaccinated. So that's why I put a lot of emphasis on education, information sharing, and supporting people to get vaccinated. There is a small element of the anti-vax people around, but by and large, my understanding in the region is that that's very a very small part of the whole scene.
You do look at social media, though, and when questions and things come up around about voluntary or mandatory vaccination, you do have quite loud voices potentially using that as fuel to spread misinformation and conspiracy theories. Dr. Colin Tukuitonga, do you think, you know, having these conversations are important, but should they be framed in a way that sort of dispels this misinformation and conspiracy theories that can sort of rise up?
Yes, I think also we need to be mindful that social media does have a particular bent, a particular bias of people who go on social media. But I do agree that obviously we need to share as much information as we can, whether it's social media or old-fashioned face-to-face meeting or print material or radio or television, whatever works in the local community. I have to say that we have been struggling with the anti-vaxxer group here because it's tied up with anti-government and anti-thing, anti-anything that's not perceived to be natural. And so we need to do our best in order to share that information with people as much as we possibly can. As I say, fortunately, my understanding is that for many of the small islands, it's not such a major problem, but nonetheless, we need to do what we can to dispel disinformation and misinformation.
And John, have you had many experiences with misinformation and conspiracy theories floating around in Fiji while the pandemic is happening?
In Fiji, it's rife. The Fijian population is very connected. The numbers that engage on Facebook are huge. Hundreds of thousands of people spend, you know, a lot of their time on Facebook. That's where the conversation is happening. That's even where government chooses to make its announcements, on Facebook. So yes, just as Colin has said, for New Zealand, we have a lot of conspiracy theories in Fiji. We have a lot of discontented people who are not happy with the government, who are the same people who are spread or who are expressed their dissension through anti-vax messages and anti-vax videos. A lot of them, you know, followed Trump. So we get that line coming into feeds via social media and algorithms. So there's been a lot of resistance on social media, and the challenge for the government and for right-minded people is to address that in an effective way on social media, to convince people that it's not going to cause magnets to stick on you. It's not going to harm most of you.
Mm. Now, John, how do you think the government is doing with its public awareness campaign? There has been some criticism, you know, from many people in Fiji saying that the messaging hasn't been 100% clear, with the Prime Minister doing midnight press conferences, the, you know, results being posted on Facebook and, you know, some days not having a, you know, a press conference about it. How do you think the messaging is going in Fiji at the moment?
With all due respect to them, I mean, operationally, they work very hard. They're very dedicated, but the messaging does need a major improvement. I mean, if this whole campaign depends on people changing their behavior, if you want people to change their behavior, you've got to speak to them directly. You've got to respect them. They've got to believe you. And, you know, like if you come on suddenly in the middle of the night, nobody's there to listen. You know, what's the point? And you also need to get it across in the vernacular. We had, you know, sign interpreters from day one, but no vernacular. How does that work?
Well, John and Dr. Tukuitonga, thank you so much for joining me this morning and having this incredibly important and robust conversation about vaccinations and COVID-19. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
That was John Apted from Fiji and Dr. Colin Tukuitonga from the University of Auckland speaking to me there. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. I'll be back at the same time tomorrow. That's 6 a.m. PNG time. You can also hear us again this afternoon at 3 p.m. PNG time. But I would really love to know what you think about vaccinations and COVID-19. Should they be made mandatory? Should they be voluntary? Have you had the vaccine? How do you feel about this conversation? You can send me a message on our ABC Radio Australia Facebook page. I'll be able to share your comments on air and potentially generate some more conversation as well. Though, stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia throughout the day. I'm Marla Damati. Thank you so much for your company. I hope you have a wonderful Tuesday.